Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon. I know we're all excited, but let's start. Very good, thank you. Hi, everyone. It's a pleasure to welcome you all here. My name is Councillor Jess Scully. I'm the Deputy Lord Mayor. I'm stepping in for Clover today. She sends her deep regrets. She wished she could have been here because, as you know, she's the patron of the Sydney Peace Foundation. But I'm sneakily very pleased that I got to do this one. Before I begin, I want to acknowledge that we're meeting today on Gadigal land and to pay our respects to elders past and present and the next generation of elders of the Eora Nation. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land. I also want to do something that Clover always does, and that is to acknowledge that we're meeting in one of the most diverse places in the world. The city of Sydney is small, about 27 square kilometres, but in that area, we're home to about 200 different cultures. And it's that global gathering of people bringing their stories, their ideas, their talents, and their ability to solve problems. That's what makes Sydney special. That's our special ability. And I'm so pleased that we can recognise that global nature of our local place today as well. Now, do I have some acknowledgements for you? We have a lot of special guests here today, so I'll get through these quickly. Of course, our guest of honour, Christiana Figueres. We have... His Excellency Armando Vargas Araya, Senator Tim Ayres, New South Wales Members of Parliament, including Jenny Leong, and then a Federal Member of Parliament, Zali Stegel. We have Roxana Tinoco Berenes, the Consul General of the Republic of Costa Rica, the Honourable Dr. Meredith Bergman, members of the Sydney Peace Foundation, Emeritus Professor Stuart Rees, founder, Archie Law, Chair, and Council members, Susan Briggs, Director, and a whole bunch of City of Sydney councillors, well, actually, two, Councillor Jess Miller, Councillor Philip Vallis. I think that's it. And, of course, City of Sydney CEO, Monica Baroni. Ladies and gentlemen, special guests all. It feels like just yesterday we were standing in this room with Christiana rocking her Stoppadani earrings. Who was here for that? Right? But it was September 2017. Time flies when you're saving the world, right? It's extraordinary. It's wonderful that Christiana was here for that city talk then, and it's wonderful to have her here now and with the Sydney Peace Foundation to acknowledge the incredible work that she's doing. Christiana Figueres is one of the great fighters in the battle against global heating and climate injustice. We cannot have justice in a world that is beset by climate change. Another one of our City Talk guests, Mary Robinson, really brought home that idea of climate justice. And I think that's central to the work that Christiana is doing. It's already those who are most disadvantaged, those whose voice is not heard, who are already feeling the effects of climate change. They are the people who don't have access to rooms like this. So it's important that we have champions like Christiana who are speaking on their behalf. That understanding is also implicit in the work of the Sydney Peace Foundation. The city has been proud to support the foundation since its work began 22 years ago. And in the years since, it has become an important part of the city's fight for justice, but also the cultural and intellectual life of our city. The foundation recognises the links between peace and justice, non-violence and human rights, and part of its mission is to make us think more deeply about the world in which we live. And that's what Christiana does too. I can't think of a more worthy recipient of this medal. Who here has read her book? Right? Okay, good, good. Fans in the room. There's a line I want to read you from Christiana's book because I think it tells us a lot about this moment that we're in. While the beginning of this period of human history has been indelibly and painfully marked, the full story has not yet been written. We hold the pen. In fact, we hold it now more firmly than ever before. And we can choose to write a story of regeneration, of both nature and the human spirit. But we have to choose. In this book, Christiana vividly shows the world that we must create, but she also shares with us the mindsets and the actions that we must take and that we must hold to get there. And that word regeneration, I think, is a really important one, because here at the City of Sydney, we had a people's jury last year, one of the most inspiring things I think I've seen in my time on council. We had 50 citizens come together and they took the 2,500 ideas from other citizens of this city. They took them, they worked through them on Saturdays. Amazing. And with a great generosity and clarity of mind, they took those 2,500 ideas and they passed them down into 8 founding principles. And principle number 1 was the idea of a regenerative city. They want a city that gives back more than it takes. And that's the opportunity that I think the City of Sydney offers the world. I think through the leadership that Clover's provided and through the work that all of our talented staff do every day, we're able to be that place where we can show what it looks like when you have affordable housing, where you provide space for people to create and come together and build community, where you put climate action first every time. That's the kind of work that I'm really proud we do at the City of Sydney. It's the kind of work the Sydney Peace Foundation supports, and it's the kind of work that Christiana champions. So thank you. And on behalf of the city, I'm so pleased to be able to welcome you here today. Thank you.
Welcome everyone. For those I don't know, my name's Archie Law. I'm the chair of the Sydney Peace Foundation, and on behalf of the foundation, welcome to everybody, and a big thank you to Jess and fellow councillors for hosting us here today in this magnificent room. And we're delighted to be here and to be joined by Christiana, of course. The Sydney Peace Foundation, we exist to shine a light on the whole notion of peace with justice, and that peace with justice, which encompasses strong, accountable governments, robust institutions that are accountable to people, creates the sort of social fabric where people have their rights respected and able to enjoy those rights to the fullest. So it's not just when the guns go silent, if you like, and the peace agreement is signed that we could say there is a peace that makes life worth living for most people. This year, or let's go last year, when the jury was meeting to deliberate over this year's events, and I really want to acknowledge the jury members that are with us today and thank them for everything they've done in preparing the program for this year. They've had quite an integral role in nominating Christiana for this award we're going to bestow upon her today, but also in selecting the recipient of this year's Sydney Peace Prize, which we'll be announcing in about 2 months' time, I think. 6 weeks? Something like that. So they've done a magnificent job. But when they were meeting, I know there was one theme that kept coming through in terms of what we should be focusing on this year, and it was climate change. And I think there might be some, probably not too many in this room, who might be saying, well, what's climate change got to do with peace? I suppose the answer is everything. Yeah. And maybe, I know that really, if I look at the core challenge of our times, and I think we hear it from everybody, it's climate change. But it's climate change which has an intersectionality with conflict, with disasters, and increasingly with epidemics, not just this one we've got right now, and the intersect of that, which is what creates this perfect storm that we're seeing. And there is no better example that I could reel off the top of my head than the situation which erupted at the beginning of the Syrian civil war in Daraa. And in the town of Daraa, I'm sure many will recall, there were a lot of farmers who were forced off their lands around Daraa in response to climate change and a lack of water, a lack of arable land. It was those farmers who were demonstrating in Daraa for their rights, for their right to a livelihood, and protesting against the government. And it was those farmers and many others who were shot down by Syrian troops, which led to the spark that started the Syrian civil war. Climate change was integral in what happened at the beginning of the Syrian civil war, and I think sparing a thought for the million displaced people, refugees who are fleeing Idlib as we sit here, living in freezing conditions in northwestern Syria and southern Turkey, climate change is having an impact on their lives right now in that very cold part of the world. So that's really why we're doing it. So again, welcome. And I'd just like to introduce our director, Susan Biggs, who's going to talk us through the award. Thanks, Susan.
Hi, everybody. Just to quote the Sydney Peace Foundation's charter, peace with justice is one of the world's most precious commodities. It involves the attainment of universal human rights, the practice of non-violence, and the promotion of a common humanity, including a responsibility to protect a precious and fragile environment. As part of achieving our vision of peace with justice, the Sydney Peace Prize spotlights remarkable global leaders, as Archie has said, and we provide a platform for them to share their message across Australia. Our gold medal for human rights is a prestigious acknowledgement of an individual's tireless commitment to human rights. Over our 22 years, it has been presented a handful of times to quite remarkable people, including Nelson Mandela, Julian Assange, and Stephanie Hessel, a former French resistance fighter and co-author of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Global heating of the planet is decidedly a human rights issue. If we don't, as most of us or all of us here know, if we don't act fast enough and we can't reduce emissions quickly enough, millions of people will experience drought, fire, and other disastrous weather-related events as a result of climate change, depriving them of basic human rights to water, food, work, housing, health, and even life. When Christiana Figueres' name first came up for this award, I approached a contact in the corporate sector to get her views. Her huge enthusiasm streamed down the phone line, and she said, quite unexpectedly and educationally, she said, "I love her. I'm a huge fangirl. She's my personal hero. She blitzed the Paris Agreement with a bottom-up feminist approach. She nails the politics across civil society, government, and business. Her outcomes are great, plus the way she goes about it." So, of course, with that ringing endorsement, I dug deeper. It was Christiana Figueres' leadership of the UN climate body in 2015 that saw a global climate deal become a reality. Her ability to collaborate and influence, her persistence and resilience, and ultimately the belief that it was possible, enabled her to effectively negotiate a deal with 195 nations harbouring a multiplicity of interests. Christiana has risen to the task of imploring us to act quickly and decisively. In her new book, The Future We Choose, she and her co-author explain what's to come, how to face it, and what we can do to move beyond the climate crisis into a thriving future. She reminds us that we need to maintain both the outrage that leaders are failing to act, and the optimism to believe that change really is possible. The Sydney Peace Foundation is awarding the Gold Medal for Human Rights to Christiana Figueres for negotiating the Paris Agreement, for ongoing global leadership, for maintaining the pressure for change, and ultimately for giving us a vision of a just and peaceful world in harmony with nature. So as a valued ally and partner, can I invite Sydney City Council Deputy Lord Mayor Jeff Scully to come up here and to award our Gold Medal for Human Rights to Christiana Figueres. And we'd love to hear a little bit from you, Christiana, if you wouldn't mind, about your work. And then we'll open up to questions.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, so much. I would like to say through you, Jess, thank you to both you and Clover for your amazing leadership in this fantastic city. I would also thank you very much, Susan, for that very beautiful and overly generous introduction. I think you're almost getting to Latin American hyperbole. You could, you know, and now you're sitting next to the Costa Rican ambassador, so maybe it's rubbing off, you know. And Archie, I would like to thank you for helping us do something that we very often forget, which is to humanize climate change. Those of us who work on climate change tend to go immediately to megawatts, gigatons, you know, all these numbers. Equivalency between the different greenhouse gases, global warming potential, all of this, all of which is completely true. And we tend to forget that ultimately climate change is not about gigatons. It's not about megawatts, it's about human beings. That is what it's really about. So thank you for reminding us of Syria. And to that, I would like to add two other stories a little bit closer to home. The first, of course, are the terrible bushfires in Australia. And I don't need to go through, again, the numbers with you, because I think we all have the numbers. I just want to remind us of the trauma that parents, mothers, children experienced when they had to leave their homes at ungodly hours of the morning and seek refuge close to water. The trauma, you know, the despair, the fright of parents, and the trauma that will be with those children who today were called the first climate refugees of Australia is something that that we really have to remember and work toward addressing climate change because of that. And because of that, where is she? Exactly because of that. And the other story that I wanted to share with you, that also here from the Pacific, picture a little town in Papua New Guinea, in one of the small islands that is a very low-lying island that whose aquifers have already had the penetration of sea level rise and have already become too salty to be able to sustain life without without desalinating somehow. Well, picture the Council of Elders coming together to decide what is going to happen here, because they have seen the waters approaching their homes and they know what is coming. So the Council of Elders takes a very painful decision and decides that those members of the community who are 50 years and younger will leave the community and the island and will be moved to mainland PNG. Same country, completely different language, completely different ecosystem, completely different cultural and agricultural traditions. Basically, it is a foreign land. But they have purchased land there, and they have been building houses for several years in order to house the families that will have to leave. So everyone 50 years and younger will have to leave the island, and everyone 50 years or older will stay on the island because someone has to be there to honor the bones of the ancestors. Now, just take that reality and superimpose it on your own family, and I think we begin to understand the pain, the human impact and the pain of climate change. So when we say that climate change is a huge threat, we can really understand that, right, from that perspective, because we understand that unabated climate change is a threat to self-determination. It is a threat to mental and physical health. It is a threat to food, water, and land. And the composite of all of that means that it is the deepest and broadest threat to the attainment of the Sustainable Development Goals that we have actually promised ourselves and future generations that we would attain by 2030. It is also the biggest threat to the progress that we have attained of social, economic, and environmental rights around the world. So not only, just to dig ourselves deeper into this reality, not only is it the greatest threat to development writ large, understood as the composite of all of the 17 SDGs, but it is also the greatest injustice. And it is the greatest injustice because it has a disproportionate impact on those who are most vulnerable and at the same time least responsible, namely women, children, and everyone at the bottom of the pyramid in every country, with a huge concentration of bottom of the pyramid population in developing countries. So you can imagine that as we approach the Paris Agreement, yes, it was about numbers, yes, it is about domestic contributions, all of that. It's about the long-term target. But fundamentally, the Paris Agreement is about human rights. We can easily understand that the Paris Agreement is actually a human rights treaty, although never negotiated as such. But it is a human rights treaty because what it seeks to do is to minimize the injustice and the human rights violations. And I use the word violations quite intentionally. Now, that is bad enough if we didn't also know that the depth and the breadth of that injustice will be determined over the next 10 years. So over the next 10 years, science is unequivocal about the fact that we will have to get to one half of the current emissions by 2030, over the next 10 years. And if we do not do that, we move into a world that is systemically a violation of all human rights. That is not a world that any of us want to live in, and particularly, it is not a world that we want our descendants to live in. So what is being done about that? Well, it has really attracted my attention that we have almost three different realities going on here at the same time. We have what I would call a political melodrama, geopolitical situation playing out on the stages, to which, of course, the United States is the major contributor. But sadly, for the time being, until this can be rectified, Australia is also contributing for the time being. But that geopolitical drama that is ongoing is not stopping us from the second pillar that we need to look at, which is what is going on in the real economy. Not in the geopolitical world, that remains there and will continue, but in the real world, it is actually quite encouraging, not comforting yet, but encouraging, that at city level, at state and territory level, at corporate level, the financial institutions, the insurance companies, and individuals are truly beginning to understand what is at stake. And at all of these levels of the system, we are beginning to see really quite bold steps forward in A, setting a target of where we need to be by 2030 and 2050, and then walking it back and saying, if that is where we need to be, then what do I need to do now? Today, tomorrow, next week, next month, next year. And honestly, that's the only way to get forward, because we are no longer in the land of gradual progress, of incremental, marginal improvement. We are now, because we have deluded, denied, and delayed so long, we are now in the space in which all progress on climate change needs to be exponential. And the good news is it can be, because We now have all of the technologies that are the technologies that will provide the solutions. They have come down in cost incredibly. We understand what the policies are. We have a very important part, although not all, of the financial sector also understanding the risks to their assets. And so all of this can actually be orchestrated and is slowly beginning to be orchestrated toward a solution space. That doesn't mean that we are where we need to go. Not yet. However, may I actually read from another book? Utopias don't arrive fully realized and perfectly formed. They happen a little bit at a time, unevenly, erratically, and if we know how to look, we can see glimpses of them everywhere. This is the book written by Jess. This is not the way it's going to look in the bookstore. This is the preprint. But how Jess manages to do city, motherhood, and writing a book at the same time, you know, I was going to say she's a woman. Jess, thank you very much. Thank you for writing a book, Glimpses of Utopia, and for giving us that sense that we are walking the path and that we have to have the vision, a powerful, compelling vision that we are working toward, but in the understanding that we are living in an imperfect world and that in this messy transition, we have both the reality of the past, which is unacceptable in the present, as well as the vision of the future, and they're both intermingled in the present, and that our task here is to reach out to the future and pull it into the present because we have run out of time. So what I've also noticed is that the international human rights system has had an approach to climate change that is diametrically oppositional to the approach that we have seen from cities, states, corporates, finance. Because the first set of stakeholders, those that are actively working on climate change, chose, for reasons that are very understandable, to go at climate change first from a mitigation point of view. Let us reduce emissions. Completely understandable because that is the urgent task. What is interesting as a contrast, however, is that the entire international system of human rights is now beginning, I would say, because we're into about year 8 or 9 of that, beginning to understand the relationship between climate change and human rights. However, they have taken the opposite approach to those that are working on so-called climate action, which is all of those, all of the members of the international human rights system have chosen to focus on the vulnerability part. Understandable, right? Because that's where you measure the human rights violations. So both of them makes a lot of sense from where they have approached this. However, I would argue that the current focus of the human rights international system on the impacts which basically are recognized post factum, and focusing on vulnerability have to occur, and it cannot be the end of that journey. It cannot be the end of the engagement of the human rights capacity with climate change, cannot end only with the extreme vulnerability, because that does not necessarily increase resilience, and it certainly does not increase the speed of mitigation or emission reduction. And so I think it is time to call the human rights system to extend its attention of the relationship between human rights and climate change beyond the already felt violations of human rights over to the preventative perspective. and understand that the human rights perspective has actually to hold both realities at the same time with equal attention and with equal urgency, because there are human beings who are already being incredibly impacted, as our stories tell, but there are millions of human beings upon whom the impact can be sizably ameliorated if we do our job on the prevention. And human rights is not looking at that yet. We're only looking at the post-factum. And so I hope that we would all collectively call upon those working on human rights to complete the picture and to remember that actually even in the health system, we know that it is better to prevent than to cure. And that wisdom also applies to human rights violations. And especially because we have to remember that according to international law, it is the obligation of every state not only to respect human rights, but also to protect and realize human rights, and to do so for all of its citizens. So while I am incredibly grateful for the attention that has been given over the past 8 years to that relationship, very critical relationship, I think it is incomplete, and I think it is urgent, especially in the urgency that we're facing over the next 10 years, which has to be an emission reduction urgency. I think it is about time that human rights also looks at the complete picture. With that, I would like to thank you thank you very much for this incredible honor. The ambassador has just told me that this is the first time a little Costa Rican citizen has been recognized in Australia. He thinks it's good news. I think it's bad news. What do you mean we've never been recognized? But it is quite an honor. Thank you very much. And thank you to the Peace Foundation. Thank you to everyone. And it only commits me to return once again to Australia. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Christiana. Thank you for the inspiration. Thank you for your leadership and that critical juncture of human rights and climate change. It doesn't get enough attention.
Yep.
And reminding us that climate action is now. We have 10 years. We've got a little bit of time. And so there's room for some questions from the room.
Sorry, we may have time for questions. We don't have time to delay on climate change. Just
that's right.
Just to clarify what we're talking about.
But we don't have much time for questions
exactly.
Either.
Okay. Well, I'm going to give you two answers to that because one is, of course, that I look for good news all the time. And when you look for something, you actually find it. So I do scour the news every day to find yet another piece that shows me that we're working on climate change. And, everywhere from, I don't know why it happens to be, but lately I've been talking a lot to the fashion industry. Isn't that odd? If you've listened to the podcast, you know that we interviewed the CEO of Gucci and recently the CEO of Stella McCartney, whose name is Stella McCartney. I was so taken by that because I thought, honestly, you know, if I were to choose 2 or 3 or 10 or 12 industries that I think really have to commit to decarbonization, fashion would not have been there. But the fact that they're already there and really committed says to me this is beginning to be mainstreamed. It's beginning to be normalized. It is no longer a few niche industries. Of course I work a lot with energy industry, with the financial industry, with transport industry, because those are with the agricultural industry, because those are the ones that first come to mind. But when it then goes down to fashion, that was like, this is fantastic, especially because on page something, I don't remember what page it is, we actually found out in the research for this book that once 20% of the corporations in any sector actually commit to a certain transformation, then the whole sector tips. And so I am beginning to see 20% in most sectors. And I think that is extraordinary news. I would not have been able to predict that just 3 or 4, certainly not 5 years ago. But the second part to your question is that that's not the only reason why I continue to be optimistic. Because optimism, for me, is a choice, is a decision. It is a very intentional, deliberate attitude toward life. If I go at any challenge in my personal life or in my professional life or, whatever, with a defeatist, fatalistic attitude, we are totally guaranteed of failure, right? I mean, try to decide that you're going to run a marathon and then tell yourself, well, actually, I don't think I can because I'm severely overweight. I don't really, think my eating habits is good. I don't really have time to train. And furthermore, I don't even know what the training schedule should be. And I probably don't have exercise clothes, right? I mean, if you start with that, well, then forget about the marathon. Don't even start there. But if you know that you have to run it and you know what the final destination is, what is the distance that you have to run, then you walk it back. And you go, okay, if that's what I'm going to do, then here's my training. This is a conversation that I was having with Zali just 2 minutes ago, isn't it? But we do that. This is the important thing. We do that in many aspects of our life anyway. Something that is really important to you, you set it out there, and then you figure out what is the path going to be to get to that destination. So why do we do it in our personal lives, and we don't do it with climate change? Well, an invitation to talk up Costa Rica is actually always very welcome because the four of us, and there are four Costa Ricans here, the four of us do come from a tiny, tiny little country, Costa Rica, but a very privileged and blessed country. To begin with, a country that abolished its army in 1948 and that took very courageous decision first to abolish the army and secondly to redirect the budget that had been gone to had been going to the army to the Ministry of Education. Hence, we have the most educated workforce in the entire continent of America, particularly including the United States. And the other place that budget went to was to the protection of our biodiversity and our nature. And hence, we have for decades we have been building our national park system. And believe you me, we didn't do it because we wanted to save the planet. We did it because we knew we don't have any minerals, we don't have any resources, mineral resources, we don't have any oil and gas, thank God, no coal. And so, what are we going to make our money from? And, well, the wise decision was taken, how about we become an eco-destination, which was at that time rather visionary, and we have been investing in that. And so, of course, ecotourism is one of our main incomes, in addition to the fact that we realized 20 years ago that because we thought that national parks on their own were enough, we were losing the forest cover outside of the parks, and we had actually gone down to 20% of the territory outside of the parks, was 25 is parks. And we thought, we can't do that because we need buffering for the national parks. So So, you know, proud little Costa Rica invented something called payment for environmental services that was then taken up by the World Bank and taken to many different countries, whereby we pay the owners of a land to actually replant and regenerate the forest. So Costa Rica went over a few years from 29% forest cover to today's 59%. See, things can be done. Yes, absolutely. And as I understand it, because I'm not a human rights person, but as I understand it from my friends, the problem that they have been having is actually proving the direct nexus, the causal nexus. And you will understand that, I mean, now that these bushfires occurred, now I think most people will accept that it was the drought and the increased temperature that led to that. But honestly, a few years ago, if you had said that in Australia, you know, you would have been, as someone told me, Tony Abbott said, talking out of your hat. But now we understand that there is actually a nexus there. And so for a lot of the human rights activists and decisions, you have to be able to prove some link there. And up until now, it has been indirect, but because attribution science of climate change is actually improving, then that is actually going to trickle over to human rights. And we will begin to have much better causal nexus arguments. Even without that, I must say, the jurisprudence and that has occurred over climate change has been amazing. In 2000, we had one litigation case on climate change, some of it with human rights, but others from different perspectives. And today, we have more than 1,300 litigation cases ongoing in the world, not surprisingly, 3/4 of those in the United States. And that is really a huge increase. And not only that, but we already have the first absolutely fantastic decision from the High Court, Supreme Court of the Netherlands, that just on December 19th, I think, or 20th, the third week of December of last year, finally it came all the way up because the Urgenda case has been going up the levels of courts, and finally the Supreme Court of the Netherlands decided that the Dutch government was not complying with the obligation to protect its citizens, and that the government had to reduce 25% of their emissions. Guess by when? By the end of 2020. So they're very busy right now. They're very busy by now. So, you know, when you have a Supreme Court that actually rules that way, you know, despite, I think that case actually started in 2015, more or less. So, you know, five years later. So it takes a while to trickle all the way up. But now that decision has been taken, I recently spoke to the president of the Inter-American Human Rights Court in Costa Rica, and she told me that that decision has actually woken up the attention of all the judges. Because now they're like, whoa, okay, we have a president here, we are going to drive this through. So kudos to a tiny little NGO called Urgenda, led by a woman who just never gave up, right? Stubborn optimism all the way.
Thank you, Christiana. I'm sorry, folks, here, we're out of time, unfortunately. But
As we are in climate change.
As we are in climate change.
Just in case you had forgotten that one.
thank you, Christiana, for joining us today. Congratulations.
Thank you, Charlie.
On being awarded the
thank
medal.
You. Thank you very much,
richly
Archie.
Richly deserved. And thank you to Jeff, the team, Monica at the City of Sydney for hosting us. Thank you to Susan, Katie, and our wonderful volunteers for for making this event happen today, and thank you to fellow councillors who are here and to all of you for joining us today. So thank you very much.